Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
All right. Wow. We are in the middle, or actually the early middle part of Acts chapter 27. We'll be in verse 13 and finishing up the chapter today through verse 44. And then begin Acts 28 and complete that. We'll be done. I think we started this in July, which is just hard for me to even fathom. But that is where we are with this. So been going through this since July. It's been a fun experience. At least it has been for me. I hope someone has gotten something out of this. We'll next, I believe, be going into Revelation and see how that goes. So that'll be a fun story for everyone. I think Revelation is a book that has been misunderstood and abused for years, and it's the hope that, well, for centuries. Not that I won't abuse it and misuse it, but I'll just bring another interpretation to Revelation because there are many based on it being apocalyptic literature, which, of course, that sort of literature is full of symbols and metaphors and other related literary elements that we really cannot take literally. So, in most cases, there are some cases you can, but not in all. Anyways, so we'll be, like I said, wrapping up Paul Acts this week and the following, and continue studying in Revelation. So where we are at this point, Paul is on his journey. It's quite a slow journey, at least up front. Well, actually, overall, it's a pretty slow journey whenever the time it actually could have taken from him to get from Caesarea to Rome. So anyways, he and several others, including the centurion, we believe Luke, and a few others, are, for the most part, port hopping from Caesarea and eventually make it to a place known as Fair Havens. It's about the time of Yom Kippur is when they have lasted there, or the Yom Kippur fast. We know that based on what we read last week related to how they got there around the time of the fast. You may just see that. They don't name it as Yom Kippur, but based on the time of year that we believe they were there, that would be what that would be. Based on the time of year, it is, of course, winter time, or very early winter. It would have made sense for them to winter there because the ships that they were on and that they would use during that time were not really ships that would travel in bad weather. And the winter on the Mediterranean Sea, at least that part of the Mediterranean Sea, was very windy. Northeasters would blow out of course, the north, and would really cause all kinds of havoc on ships and other seafaring vessels as they were trying to, you know, navigate the Mediterranean. So most of the time, many would find a place to port and stay over winter. It seems they've made a different decision, and they've decided to go on. As we remember from last week, the council on the ship decided to go a different route and to see if they could make it to the next port, which they seem to believe would be a little bit better place to stay over the winter. Well, don't want to be a spoiler on this one. It does not work out as what they had hoped or what they had planned. So we're going to start here in verse 13 and run through verse 20. Yeah, let's start there and then have a little discussion and see where we see where Paul takes us. Or actually Luke, since he's writing this, where he takes us. Verse 13 of chapter 27 of Acts. When a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed an anchor and began sailing along Crete, close inshore. But before very long, rushed down from the land a violent wind called Euryclo. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. Notice how tense changes from they to we here at this point. As we know, Luke does that throughout this book. It depends where, of course, what his participation is. You could assume the they there in verse 13 was they, the sailors, and the captain of the ship. But we, the passengers, and everyone else, is what we see here in verse 15, running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, We were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. Well, that's weird. A ship's boat? Yes, we'll talk about that. I imagine many of you already know what that means, but we'll keep on going. After they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor, and in this way let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, began to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, with no small storm was assailing us. From then on, all hope of being saved was gradually abandoned. So what was initially the Gilligan's Island tour has turned into something significantly different. So Paul and his shipmates are caught up in the wind. Euryalo, also known as a storm at sea, is what the name of it. That was what they would refer to it. We would call it a storm at sea. They would call it the Euryalo wind. They had made their decision to move on to the port of Phoenix, and soon after that, the nice gentle wind was there out of the south, pops up and moves them forward. So they have the nice southerly wind, which is something that they would really appreciate. So they decide at that point to leave Fairhaven's, sticking close, of course, to shore. They make their way around the Cape of Matala, and it was there, actually, it would have only been a few-hour trip from Cape Matala. So it was actually a relatively quick trip from New Haven Fairhaven's to this new port in Phoenix that they were looking for. So they make their way around, the idea of being the favorable wind would whisk them across the wide mouth of the Gulf of Massera, which I don't know how many miles that is, but it was significant. I may have put that in my notes further in. But it was a decent amount of open sea travel that they would have to do. But with the winds that they had at that point, it made sense for them to do that. So like I said, as they were taking their Gilligan tour across the Gulf, an unexpected wind from the north, coming from Mount Ida, which if you were to look at that island in which they're coming around the island of Crete, you'd be able to see that Mount Ida still stands there, of course, still there, not necessarily in the middle, but middle part of the island. And apparently a lot of winds would blow down from that. Based on what we can guess from this, and based on the significant amount of research that people who study ocean-going trips and seafarers and those who understand how nautical winds work, they would guess that they were probably, not guess, probably a better word, they would estimate they were about halfway across that gulf, the Gulf of Massara, at that point. The use of the wind in which they're caught up when in the Euryalo, I always want to say Euryalo, but it's only one L. So Euryalo would have been also referred to as a typhonic wind, a whirlwind of sorts that struck them and then continued after the whirlwind would come and hit them. The straight winds would come, pushing them further away from their destination. So a northeaster coming down and blowing them away. The wind was recognized by the sailors. They knew what they were. They'd been around this. They'd been through it before. And of course, so that it had become so familiar to them as those who were sailors that they gave it a name. And today we'd pronounce it as, I guess it's referred to as the more modern version of this would be a griggle. So Grigal. So they would have known very familiar with what this is. In verses 15 and 16, the ship would have no chance in this type of wind. So any chance of making Phoenix at this point were absolutely gone. Again, based on research of those who study nautical trips and those who are seafaring experts, the idea is that they were probably pushed about 23 miles southwest to the island of Kada, the modern name of Gabdos, Gabdhos, where there would be a port, but it was on the northern side of the island, which, of course, based on how that port would be situated there on the island, it would be of no help to them. So they decided they'd go around. They were able to go around and were protected for a short time from the wind as they were able to make the bottom part of that trip okay there in Clauda. The ship's boat, of course, is a dinghy, so it's a small boat, of course, that they would use to if they anchored out away from shore, they would take the dinghy in, and that's what he's referring to here. It typically would trail the ship, and this is the, like I said, what the ship's boat is whenever Luke is referring to it here. Depending on your translation, it may come across as a little bit of a different word. But I haven't seen, neither one of these translations would bring that up. Maybe a rowboat could be another use of that. Anyways, that's what they are dealing with here. Based on this account, it seems he was all in. When it came to hauling in the ship and how difficult it must have been, it was probably already full of water and the main ship a bit rocky. So he was part of that. So we, like I said, the tenses are changed. We now get this third, first person plural of the, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. Imagine they needed everyone who is able to help pull this heavy ship full of water onto the major ship, onto the main ship. So we have now a we scenario versus they. It was certainly they when they took off, because it was they as in their idea, but now they are all in this together, so now we're into a we situation for Luke. After they hoisted up the dinghy, they were then to put cables around the main ship to help hold the ship's timbers together, keep it from breaking up. Pliny the Elder, who is a Roman naval army commander, and also, it's amazing what these people would do. He was also known as a naturalist, a historian, and a philosopher. Was very familiar with this kind of typhoon that Luke is describing here. And this would look like an account where if they would not have girded up the ship as they were doing here, it would have been that the ship would have instantly broken up. Not instantly, but very quickly broken up. During that time, vessels were already kind of pre-equipped or fitted with cables for bracing the hulls to enable them to resist this type of wind. So they knew this was going to happen, or they were already prepared for this sort of situation, kind of an emergency situation they never hoped would happen, but would happen and did happen. And so they already had those cables in place. And so once that boat was, the dinghy or the rowboat was already there and secured, it was now time to kind of gird up the loins of the ship. So that's what they were able to do at that point. The third precautionary measure that they take as we read through this, as they were going along the lee or the shelter of the island of Akata, they lowered an instrument to the water that would be seen some sort of drift or floating anchor. And it was placed astern, is my understanding, to help offer the most amount of resistance possible to the wind. So a few different types of anchors are used throughout this story, instruments. And maybe Luke didn't know what exactly it was called or was not familiar with it. Remember, he's a doctor. He's not a sailor, so he's probably not as familiar with seagoing equipment as some of the others would be. The fear that they're facing here is that as we look there into these last few verses here from 18 to 20 or 17 through 20, the fear of the sailors was that they would end up in Greater Syrtis, which is just right to the north of modern day Libya. So as you can imagine, if they're trying to head to Rome, and they're worried that they're going to end up in modern day Libya, which is of course North Africa, they knew how powerful this wind could be and where how far off it could take them. And most likely their ship would not even make it that far. But the concern was if they did make it to Syrtis, they would be stuck in these the quicksands that are off the coast there of Libya, and would not be able to do anything to get out of there. So what they're to do here is that the ship, then what they did is they maneuvered the ship to where the right side of the ship was to the wind. The storm sails seemed to be set, and they drifted slowly at about 1.5 miles per hour in a direction 8 degrees north of west. It's amazing what these people are able to figure out based on how they know the winds of the Mediterranean work. This is not my own calculations. This is calculations I found from some commentaries that I read on this, and it seems to be pretty consistent in the understanding how this all worked out. We have to take it for what it is, because unless you're a sailor or understand how nautical winds work in the Mediterranean, you really don't know if they're saying the right thing or not. But it seems like it's a legitimate understanding of where they could have ended up and how they kept themselves from ending up where they possibly could have been if they had not taken care of business. Verses 18 and 19, similar to what we see in Jonah, they begin to jettison some of the cargo since the wind would not stop. It is not explicitly said, so this is assumed of what everything they're tossing off. The last thing that would be sent over, of course, was the wheat. You have to remember this was a wheat-carrying ship or a wheat-hauling ship, most likely coming from Alexandria, Egypt, and was heading up to Rome. And remember that Egypt at that time was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. And the owner or the captain, ship's owner or the captain, that would have been the last thing you'd want to send over because that's how he made his money. It wasn't a government-owned ship. It was a government-contracted ship, and the ship owner would, of course, make money based on the wheat that he was able to bring to the government. So, of course, the livelihood of the ship owner would be spared to the very end. The spare gear of the ship is sent over as well, and that includes the mainyard. My understanding is being extra would be the like an extra mast that was to be used if, I guess, the main mast was broke. At least maybe I misunderstood that interpretation, but that's what my understanding of that would be. Verse 20, they haven't seen the sun or stars for several nights. They've made it through what we'd see at this point, 11 very uncomfortable nights. And with the cloud cover, they were not able to see the sun or the stars to be able to understand where they really were in the great sea. So they had the ability, of course, and I assume there's still other seafaring folks today who could still look at stars and identify kind of, and I will be able to identify and understand where they were when they were out on the sea. So that's how they, of course, would use it before there's additional technology to kind of help them be more specific. You have to imagine 11 days in being beat up like this because it doesn't seem like the wind ever lets up. The wind's in pretty bad shape at this point. It's possibly taking on water. It seems like at this point the hope is being lost. There is some hope that maybe they'll find some of the nearest land and run the ship aground. And with anyone in this situation, as you can imagine, I would imagine any of us in this situation, that we would see that as hope was draining away as the days continued to fade from one to the next. And so that's where we are as we go through verse 20. The next section is verses 21 through 26. I'll read that. We'll see here when all hope is being lost. It's not all about to be lost. It seems like all hope is draining at this point. Paul encourages the crew to go on and keep on keeping on. So let's read verses 21 through 26 and have a little discussion about that. When they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice and ought to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss." Well, that's not a good way to start, is it? But he makes a point. "Yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For this very night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you.'" This is not the first time that an angel or a representative of God has come and said, "Hey, Paul, you're going to make it to Rome, so it'll be okay. It may be a little rough, but you're going to make it." So this is a confirmation of that original affirmation that he was going to make it there. Verse 25, "Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I've been told, but we must run aground on a certain island." Of course, Paul was not told by the angel what island they would run upon, but hopefully it was a island that would be something that they could at least winter on and prepare to move on to their next destination. It would be very difficult to have prepared or eat any sort of food. And during those 11 days at sea is probably a rough ride. A lot of the food was probably ruined by seawater. Some of it probably had already been thrown over. You can imagine what it had been like of feeling the seasickness for many of those who were not used to being in the sea, on the sea. And then, of course, even for seasoned sailors, it's probably pretty rough. Phew. Oh. So Paul stands up one morning, it seems, and does what many of us would be tempted to do, but probably wouldn't say, and for the most part says, I told you so. But he has a good explanation after he says it, or not an explanation, but he has good words to say after I told you. So this is a very human response that allows us to better relate with Paul. It makes him seem much more human that he would stand up and say this. And he says it to the men, so you can assume he may have just said it, not to everyone on the ship, or a larger group of people on the ship, but maybe just to the captain and the other sailors and possibly the centurion and some of the soldiers. So who knows? So we don't know who they are, but he does refer to them. It just seems like it's a smaller group that he's referring to when he says that. Verses 22 through 24, after the I told you so, he then provides them with words of hope and encouragement, as Paul is very good and as a good leader would do. He speaks as one with authority and divine reassurance, which he has both of those things. He speaks as who is experienced traveler with sound judgment. Remember, he has already been in a shipwreck. He's already gone through a lot of stuff, so he could have that sort of experience that he can learn the lessons on and then move forward from that. And for those of you who are following along, the shipwreck was, if you go to 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25, he references that there. At that time, there was considerable loss of life, and it seems, that's whenever he, let me say that. So if you do go to 2 Corinthians 11, 25, you'll see that the story there was a little bit different, as in there was considerable loss of life. And it seems that he may have floated in the open sea for at least a day, if not longer, until he is finally rescued. So he's hoping not to have to do that all over again. The difference now is he knows that no life will be lost, though there will be the loss of the ship and there'll be loss of the cargo and the wheat. No human will die. And Paul has that promise, and Paul has faith in God that that is true, and God will do what he says. At this point, his comments are more from a divine reassurance than from his own experience of seeing this happening. He's just knowing that he needs to trust in God. He's had a supernatural revelation, which this is a assurance is communicated to him. And we consider this to be, of course, an angel of God who came to him. I remember about two years ago, Paul was already assured by an angel that he would make it to Rome, and that was in chapter 23, verse 11. Again, it is reassured and amplified at this point. Not only Paul would be spared, but so would everyone else on the ship. Remember earlier on, Paul had said there would be life lost if they would take this journey from Fairhaven's to Phoenix. And so he comes back now, is like, no life will be lost. So that's pretty good news for those who are following along. Verses 25 and 26, Paul has been fully persuaded based on his faith in God that things would turn out just as God said they would, that he would fully make it to Rome, the ship would wreck, but the people would make it ashore. Not sure where at this point based on what he says, but we know eventually they make it to the island of Malta. If you've read ahead, you know that. There was no other option based on the current direction of the wind, so that was kind of their last hope. Paul did not know this, but he's basing this on his hope. And, you know, we all have that chance to hope, to have faith, to believe that what God says is true, and to live in a way that we believe that what God says is true. And that's what Paul is doing here. If they would have missed Malta, they probably had another 200 miles and then would be around Tunisia, which was there'd be little chance that the ship would make it that far. So their last hope literally was Malta. And so that's, I guess, where they ended up, as we will see. In verses 27 through 29, let's read that first. But when the 14th night came, as we were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms, and a little further on, they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms. Fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. There continues to be in a desperate situation, but there is a glimmer of hope, not just based on what Paul had just said, but based on this opportunity that they may have of reaching land soon. There have been many seafaring historians who have looked into this to see how far they could have drifted with this type of ship. The conclusion had been about 36 miles in 24 hours. The land that they may have been close to based on the soundings was Kura, a point off the east coast of Malta. Based on all this, Clotta by the night of the 14th to be less than 3 miles from the entrance of what they would refer to as St. Paul's Bay. And based on the author's description, Luke's of course, without any inaccuracies, they can be very certain that their only option was Malta. We can be very certain that their only option was Malta because we're believing that what Luke is saying is as accurate as possibly could be. The Sea of Adria is the central Mediterranean. This is different from the Adriatic Sea. So you may be reading that in your translation as Adriatic Sea, but it's actually the Sea of Adria that he is referring to, which is different from the Adriatic Sea, of course. Adriatic Sea is part of what the historian Ptolemy had called the Adriatic Sea, but that's, you know, it's just a different part of the Mediterranean. There's been some confusion that Paul and the others were blown into the Adriatic Sea in the past because of the way this is reading. If you do a plain text reading of this, you'll think that they got blown into the Adriatic Sea, but would not have been possible with the northeastern wind because the Adriatic Sea was actually north of them, and if they were getting blown from the north to the south, they couldn't have made it up north. So it was not the Adriatic Sea as we like to think of it. When the sailors had a feeling they were close to land before it was light outside was based on reading as some land was resounding in their ears is probably one way to think about that. And what that means, if you read that, so that's kind of an awkward saying of what we see here in this verse, is some land was resounding in their ears, similar to the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. That's a whole lot easier to read in English, not as awkward. But what we're seeing with that is most likely what they were hearing. They're hearing the waves break against rocks, and to them they understood that apparently they were close to a bay, or they were close to a shore. The breakers were hitting the rocks quite violently, which allowed them to see them, and if there was, the wind was blowing as it was from the northeast, that would make a lot of sense. So when they took the soundings, as we go into verses 28-29, it'd be after they determined they heard the breakers. So they heard the breakers, and then they took the soundings. This would help them to be able to know the land was approaching, and it would be time to prepare the anchors. Most likely, some people would estimate that the timing between the two soundings was probably about a half an hour, based, I guess, on typically how that would happen when they took soundings there in the ocean or sea. Knowing they were close and it was dark meant they needed to slow down in order not to hit the rocks at night. I guess they were heading there pretty quick. So they put the forward anchors down as a break. It was not typical to anchor from the stern, but in order for the ship to be beached, this kept the prow or bow pointing to shore, and which was the strongest part of the ship. So they wanted to get the ship in the right orientation, so when it was going to head into shore and break into the rocks or the sand or mud or whatever they hit, they would be using the strongest part of the boat. If they would have anchored it from the bow, the wind would have twisted them around, causing the weaker part of the ship to be exposed. So they, though it was not typical of what they were doing, it was something that had to happen in that time based on the way the wind was blowing. Verses 30 through 32, but as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved. Then the soldiers do something nuts here. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. So some of the sailors, as we see here, are attempting to escape, but their attempt fortunately is foiled by Paul. Fortunately, not only for Paul and the centurion and there the soldiers and everyone else on the ship, but for the sailors as well, because most likely they would not have made it ashore. So they were attempting to abandon ship there in verse 30. While acting, it seems they were trying to lay out anchors from the bow as well as from the stern, but their intent actually was to jump in that boat and make it off to shore. Paul detected what they were up to, and based on his limited nautical experience, he informs the centurion about how bad it could be if they did not all remain on the ship, and well, how bad it would be for them if they remain on the ship because of the promise he got from God, but how his nautical experience, knowing that If they're doing anchors like this, they're not really doing the anchors. The anchors are already out, and what are they trying to do? So he sees enough and knows enough to know that they're not really doing what they're acting like they're doing. The other part of this is that the sailors were the only ones who were experts of how the ship worked and how the ship floated and how to navigate the ship to wreck it. And so they needed their expertise. And so if they would have left, they wouldn't have only probably died on the way in. They everyone else would have as well, because there's been no one to help lead or drive or guide the ship into the shore. So it was also needed for them just to stay on, just so they would be able to help out. This time the centurion there in verse 32 listens to Paul, but may have been a little impulsive by having the soldiers cut the dinghy. It could have been used later. If you think about it, once they got a little bit closer to shore and the boat kind of grounded there in the sand and the mud, they probably could have used that boat to help get people back and forth or to shore from the wrecked boat. But it seems it was probably the best move, and it's hard to second guess the centurion 2,000 years ago, but to him it's probably the best move and the best way to keep everyone on board and anyone else from trying to escape, because they really don't know still when they're going to get off the boat and if the boat's even going to make it long enough for them to stay on the boat to be able to get off of it later. Verses 33 through 38. Until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that he had been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you will perish." Having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and he began to eat. All of them were encouraged, and they themselves took food. All of us in the ship were 276 persons, depending on which translation you read. It could also be 76 people. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea. So these are the final throes of the storm and the final last desperate attempt for them to be able to make it to shore. For the most part, Paul provides a Last Supper, and it would be noticed by those who were Christians that what he's doing is the Lord's Supper, and it's also the Last Supper on the ship. So look at it however you want, for those who are believers or not believers to understand what's going on. Either way, what they're needing to do there is to increase their strength, because they're about to do a big swim from wherever the boat hits to shore, and they're also about to unload a bunch of stuff off the boat, so they had to be able to have their strength. They had not eaten, as we see here, for at least 14 days. Based on where they are right now, it seems maybe the storm has settled down a little bit, which will allow them to at least make something or prepare food somehow. And as we look in verses 35 and 36, Paul does his communion. He takes the bread and breaks it. He gives thanks in a way that everyone aboard could hear his prayer of thanksgiving. Based on the pattern that he does, that Paul took in eating, he gave thanks, he broke bread. Much like the Eucharistic setting that we knew from the Last Supper, and much like a lot of people practice to this day. So he does that pattern, follow the same pattern that that Jesus did at the first Lord's Supper, and things continue to do to this day. One thing is interesting here, just a detail, is that there's no mention of wine. And there's actually no mention of wine in any of Acts. It's the idea of wine or cup is absent in all of Acts. And it's one of those observations that you catch after reading the entire book and then catching a Eucharist moment and noticing there's only bread here. So you wonder here, do you always, when you take communion or the Eucharist, do you have to have wine or whatever product you'd like to drink? We'll just say wine just because that's what they say in the Bible, but it's just interesting to see that. So can you have a Lord's Supper with just bread? And I think I would believe so, as Paul demonstrates that here. It's the idea of what you're remembering. It's not if you're doing every step exactly right and every element's involved. So that's kind of my viewpoint here. Verse 37, this is the debate of the ancient evidence of the actual number of people who were on the ship. Was 76 and not 276. There's no reason there could not have been 276 people. It wasn't like it was not even possible. There were other times, and like there's a ship that Josephus was on that he's actually talked about, that he wrote about, where he had taken, I guess, 4 years later and had 600 people on it. So the boats were big enough to have that amount of people. And it's just kind of interesting that they bring it up. But there's debate, and the debate is based on whatever manuscript that you're using to do your translation, and however you're interpreting that number that's out there in ancient Greek. The reason I think this number is brought up, and why others think this number has been brought up, is because it gives them kind of an idea of how many people are on the ship, and how they should divide up the food and how they should prepare it. Not how they should prepare it, but how much they should prepare based on it. And Luke, as we know, is a writer who likes to provide a lot of detail, and that's what he's doing here. He provides additional detail that you typically would not need, but it just makes the story a little bit more depth to it. In verse 38, with their newfound strength from eating, they're able to push over the weak cargo. As we know from verse 18, part of it had already been thrown over, but enough was kept for ballast as well as for food, and so that's all good things. This would, of course, by lightening the ship, would allow the ship to float higher in the water so that it could make it closer to the beach. It was an extreme measure. It had to be done, and it's a huge, significant financial loss to the boat owner, ship owner. Boo for him, yay for everyone, including him, that they actually made it ashore. So, you know, we are where we are with this. Verse 39, let's just read the rest through verse 44, and we'll wrap up chapter 27. When day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a bay with the beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they let them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind, they were heading for the beach. But striking reef where two seas met, they ran the vessel aground, and the prow struck fast and remained immovable, but the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would escape, swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to bring Saul safely through, kept him from their attention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest should follow, some on planks, others on various things from the ship. And so it happened that they all were brought safely to land. That's chapter 27. And so let's look at these final verses here of chapter 27. They end up being a bit off from where they thought they were going to land, closer to St. Paul's Bay. St. John's Bay is that thing from JCPenney. St. Paul's Bay is completely different, isn't it? They see a creek that leads out into the bay, and they're between both sand and rock. It's a very tricky situation that they're in. And apparently this bay and the way the bay is set with the sand and the rock and the entrance in is still visible to this day. There are other ports and other bays and entrances that are not, based on earthquakes, volcanoes, erosion. But so it's interesting that some of these, if you go today, you can still see exactly, not exactly, but you can see an idea of what they saw. Verse 40, they no longer have the use of the anchors, so they send them away and left them in the sea. Today they'd probably get fined for that, but that's okay. It was a desperate times equal desperate measure. At the same time, they cut off the lashings of the steering paddles, which at the same time, of course, at that time, these paddles would be what we'd refer to as rudders on ships. They put a small sail the foresail, I believe it was called. Yep, there in verse 40. That would be used to help guide and direct them in. So they used it for steering and not for, say, to pick up speed. So that was used for, of course, steering. Unfortunately, verse 41, they did not see one more obstacle that lay in the way as they entered the bay. The bay is sheltered on the northwest by the island of Salmonetta, not Salmonella, but Salmonetta, and is separated from the main island, Maltese, by a narrow channel of about 100 yards wide. That may not seem very narrow, but if imagine this crazy situation, it seemed very narrow. Referred to as the place between two seas. At this point is where the ship would strike a significant amount of mud. the translation here would be a tenacious type of clay to which the forepart of the ship stuck and held fast and would not be moved. And at that point, of course, the stern of the boat was exposed to the waves, and the waves had been beaten up on for the last 14 days and continued to beat up on it, and as strong as they were, started breaking the boat apart. Fortunately, as we see here in verse, the front of the boat, 41, yeah, the front of the boat was actually able to hold up pretty well until everyone was able to get off the ship. Verses 42 through 44, they were able to make it safely ashore. As it was a tradition of that time for the soldiers to be fully responsible for the prisoners, the best option for them that they thought, so no one would escape, because if they, if a prisoner escapes, it's death to the soldiers. It would, for the most part, they would kill them. And so instead of them themselves being killed by an escaping prisoner, they would kill the prisoners, and then no prisoners escaped, and everyone wins. Well, besides the prisoners who were just killed, but at least the soldiers don't. The centurion, of course, sees it a different way, knowing he needs Paul to be kept safe and alive to get him into Rome. So he tells the soldiers not to kill the prisoners, but to round them up. The idea would be once ashore, the soldiers, it's not a big island, the soldiers would be able to track down anyone who tried to run, and then, of course, could be able to set a perimeter around them and keep them from escaping. Paul's angelic messenger certainly had told the truth and all made it ashore. Some, it seems, by swimming, based on how this reads, some by hanging on parts of the ship, and some by hanging on to other people, which I believe is referred to as various things. Is it the should follow? Anyways, if I remember the translation right, it was that they for those who cannot swim or had no ability to swim, they clung to others who were able to swim. So anyway, very interesting to see how this ends up. So they make it safely to Malta, and this will take us to the final chapter of Acts, and which has been a fun journey to get to this point. And we'll see what happens to Paul and his friends as they spend their a decent amount of time in Malta, and then eventually are able to take off in about 3 months, I believe, they're on Malta. They're able to make it, jump on another wheat hauling ship from Alexandria and make their way to Rome. And that is where we end today. It's a big day. It's a big day. Well, thank you for everyone for listening and following along. And we will throw out chapter 28 maybe next week or the following week. It just kind of depends on the schedule with the kids being out of school and everything. So thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.